Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. I'm happy to present our second episode on the forest in fiction. Now, we couldn't treat this subject without talking about the woods in fairy tales. Some of you will remember an episode I did a while back with the fairy tale expert Maria Tatar, in which we talked about Little Red Riding Hood, and in particular, the wolf in the woods. In that episode, I talked a bit about the psychoanalyst Bruno Bettelheim and his famous book, The Uses of Enchantment, The Meaning and Importance of Fairy Tales. This is what he has to say about the woods in his book. Since ancient times, the near impenetrable forest in which we get lost has symbolized the dark, hidden, near impenetrable world of our unconscious. In preparing this episode, I was curious about that relationship between the forest and the unconscious, and I thought it would be fun to explore. What is it, I wondered, about our psychic journeys that the forest of fairy tales represents? I was lucky enough to speak with Ellen Handler Spitz, a renowned specialist of psychology in the arts and senior lecturer in the humanities program at Yale University. She is the author of numerous books, including Art and Psyche, Image and Insight, Museums of the Mind, as well as several books on children's literature. For those of you who would like to explore her work, I'll put up links on our website, in-the-weeds.net. When I contacted Ellen, she suggested that rather than focus on the fairy tales themselves, we talk about Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine's musical, Into the Woods, in which they combine several of the Grimm's fairy tales and come up with something altogether new. Here's Ellen on the topic.
Its psychological sensitivity is absolutely unique. And when you approached me about discussing the symbolism, the significance of the woods, it seemed to me that this was front and center because the woods is the eponymous character of right. the show. And the woods is central to everything that happens in this.
If you've never seen Into the Woods, I'm going to suggest something unusual. I'm going to suggest that you pause this episode and go and watch it on video before you continue. Of course, ideally, you would want to see it in a theater, but until that's possible, you can watch it online. Our wonderful local theater, Arc Stages, in Pleasantville, New York, kindly let me use some audio from their terrific production from 2014, and you can watch that wonderful production in full on YouTube. I'll put up the link in the episode notes and on the website. You can also pay to watch the original Broadway production on Amazon, and probably other places as well. Then, of course, there's the Hollywood movie. And though it has some wonderful performances, I especially love Tracy Ullman in the role of Jack's mother. I have a soft spot for Tracy Ullman because she lived next door to my best friend in high school. But that's another story. The problem with the movie is that it veers from the original libretto in ways that I think significantly change the impact of the story. But the other thing is that Into the Woods is designed for the stage. It's very carefully structured, and although the movie allows the director to give us some beautiful forest scenery, I personally think the musical doesn't quite work when separated from the stage. Okay, this episode is going to be a little different from other ones in that my guest, Ellen Handler Spitz, is going to begin by offering us a reading of The Role of the Woods in Into the Woods. Afterwards, she and I chat about the forest in the musical and sometimes veer off on different paths. Here we go.
Once upon a time, in a far-off kingdom,
Into the Woods is divided into two parts. And part one brings together several well-known fairy tales in a three-way split stage format. And as audience, we cycle among them as their stories are occurring simultaneously. And little by little, the characters meet up with one another, which is an amazing conceit all by itself. And all of these principal characters, by the end of part one, have seen their dreams come true, their wishes come true. Cinderella has been to the palace. She has danced with and married the prince. Jack has felled the giant and acquired the hen that lays golden eggs. Little Red Riding Hood has escaped the wolf, and she now sports a furry new cape that her grandma has made her. The baker and his wife have undone the witch's spell of barrenness and realized the fulfillment of their wish to have a child. Rapunzel has gone off with her prince, and even the witch has regained her former beauty, albeit at the cost of her power. The mean stepsisters are punished with blindness, which is, of course, a concretization of their previous moral blindness, which they now belatedly understand. However, whereas some fairy tales, notably French ones especially, if you can think, for example, of Beauty and the Beast, Belle et la Bête, end with a happily ever after motif, Into the Woods Part 2 shatters fantasies of blissful fulfillment. And moral questioning bludgeons its way center stage. At what price do wishes come true in the woods? At what cost does one follow the forceful advice of the baker's wife to her husband in part one when she sings, "If you know what you want, then you go and you find it and you get it." Part two reveals the unforeseen consequences of this narrowly focused advice. Wish fulfillment cannot be the end of the story. Jack, having chopped down the beanstalk, causes the giant's death. And although his sole culpability is gradually and importantly thrown in question, this death impels the giant's bereaved wife to seek vengeance. Life and love and desire and maturation do not stand still, but remain in process. Not only does the end not justify the means, but moral blame, as these characters learn, rarely accrues to one person alone. Others subtly partake. What about the woods? Over and again, every character goes into the woods. Why? To fill heart's desire, to discover truth, to obey a parent, to undergo loss, to meet sudden death, to mourn, to regroup, to come at length, to accept mutual dependence as well as reliance on self, to grow up, to find hope in the wake of disaster. But why the woods? Let's consider the first scene that actually takes place there. It stars Cinderella, who goes into the woods to beg help from her deceased mother, now a tree, nourished by the girl's tears.
Cinderella had planted a branch at the grave of her mother, and she visited there so often and wept so much that her tears watered it until it had become a handsome tree.
I've been good and I've been kind, Mother Julie, only what I learned from you. Why then am I left behind, Mother? Is there something more that I should do? What is wrong with me, Mother? Something must be wrong. I wish.
And this soulful image of the mother as tree might recall Ovid's Daphne from the Metamorphosis, or Dante, as in your last podcast, Nicole, wonderful podcast on Dante, Dante's dreary wood in the seventh circle of Canto 13 of the Inferno, where the speaking suicides are encased in trees. Cinderella is distraught, of course, at being left behind while her selfish stepmother and stepsisters depart in splendor for the palace ball. Wisely, her good mother asks her to be clear. Specify what you wish for. And next, she says to Cinderella, "Are you certain that what you wish is what you want?" This crucial distinction, unnoticed at first, is brilliantly demonstrated later in Cinderella's song, one of the key songs on the steps of the palace. Because now, having met the prince, danced with him, seen his palace, and found the pitch on her shoes with which to trap her, she confronts the unclarity and probable ramifications of her wish, should it be granted, and she knows how unsure she is. So as she vacillates, trying to fathom the meaning and consequences of letting herself, as she says, stay and be caught, or running away and returning to her accustomed misery, where, as she sings, when there's nothing to choose, there's nothing to lose. And she ends, as we know, by evading choice, by leaving just a clue, as she puts it, her slipper, so that now it's he and not you. The decision, in other words, will be his, not hers. And I think we witness in this moment a gentle abdication of will, a retreat from the burden of self-determination and responsibility, a refusal of the logical necessity for either or. And I want to underscore this absence of need to choose, because I think this is central to the nature of the woods. To understand better, let's skip now to part two, to a key scene in the woods. After the characters know that the enraged giantess is threatening to kill Jack, they're eager to find him and protect him. And the baker's wife leaves their new baby, the Little Red Riding Hood, and urges her husband to separate from her so that they can fan out and search more effectively.
Are we really gonna let her feed the boy to the giant? No.
No, I will have to find him first.
I'll go too.
No, you stay here with the baby.
We'll fan out. It'll increase our chances of finding the boy.
This scene is uncannily reminiscent of Milton's Paradise Lost, where just before the fall, Eve urges Adam to separate from her and work apart so that they'll be able to prune more trees in the garden. Adam, like the baker, wants her to stay with him, and fearing evil, he protests. Similarly, the baker worries, what if one of us gets lost? But like Eve, the baker's wife departs, and like Eve, she meets temptation. Cinderella's prince appears, surprising her and flattering her. Like the serpent, he seduces her in the woods. Then immediately he abandons her, noting with nonchalance, this was just a moment in the woods. Alone now, the baker's wife questions herself. And I want to quote this solo because I feel it has keys to the meaning of the woods. Was that me? Was that him? Did a prince really kiss me and kiss me? And did I kiss him back? Was it wrong? Am I mad? Is that all? Does he miss me? She stops herself. Back to life, back to sense, back to child, back to husband. No one lives in the woods. And reminding herself of the giantess' threat and her own quest to find the boy, she tells herself, face facts, but then, was that him? Yes, it was. Was that me? No, it wasn't. Just a trick of the woods. And that's what the woods are for. And she recalls, first a witch, then a child, then a prince, then a moment. Who can live in the woods? Let the moment go. Don't forget it for a moment, though. Just remembering you've had an and when you're back to or makes the or mean more than it did before. Now I understand, and it's time to leave the woods. After this, the baker's wife turns and starts to count her steps back to her husband, when suddenly she hears the approach of the giantess, crashing noise, flashing lights, blackout, fade out. her kernel of self-knowledge attained, she departs the scene forever. She has died. So what can we say? And what of the woods? I'd like to suggest now that we see the woods as what I want to call the province of and, the domain of that which is irrational, improbable, fantastical, the place where wishes come true, but unsustainably, the place where you don't have to choose, but where you can't stay for long. No one lives in the woods. The place of untold promise, but of hidden, sudden danger. The place that bypasses laws of logic and causation in favor of the stratagems pertinent to dreams, make-believe and reverie, allegory, metaphor, metonymy, contiguity, where rational choice, the right answer as either A or B, morphs into a fluid state where both are held simultaneously, but only for a moment. It's a province we know, a mental state in which we all partake necessarily, but which, untamed, proves incompatible with a human life lived in concert with other human beings. Psychoanalysis speaks of the unconscious, that part of the mind which enters our awareness only by way of substitutes, a mother as a tree, a princess in a tower, a cow is milky white, a harp that plays itself, a witch who trades in spells for youthful beauty. Is power intrinsically ugly? But let's turn quickly now to one more meditation. I'd like to focus on a little Red Riding Hood, who, of course, as we all know, strays off her path into the woods. There, the wolf lasciviously accosts and entices her. She finds him in her grandmother's bed. He swallows her. She is saved, and she reflects.
And he showed me things, many beautiful things that I hadn't thought to explore. They were off my path, so I never had dared. I had been so careful, I never had cared. And he made me feel excited, well, excited and scared.
Sexuality and violence unleash themselves in the woods, where you may by chance encounter what you had previously shunned. And I know things now, many valuable things that I hadn't known before. Do not put your faith in a cape and a hood. They will not protect you the way that they should.
And I know things now, many valuable things that I hadn't known before. Do not put your faith in a cape and a hood. They will not protect you the way that they should.
And the little girl ends exquisitely in epistemic, ethical, and aesthetic doubt. She says, "Isn't it nice to know a lot and a little bit not?" So, how does the woods bring forth all of this introspection and pondering and change? Remember how the baker finally learns to trust and share with his wife.
Perhaps it will take the two of us to get this child.
You've changed. You're daring. You're different in the woods. More sure, more sharing. You're getting us through the woods. If you could see, you're not the man who started.
Perhaps because this, the woods, is where we retreat to find and feel what is often forbidden to us elsewhere, in civilization, at home, in school, at the office. It's where we can meet a wolf or a witch, a giant, a spell, or a prince, and where we can learn in Cinderella's words, "You are not alone. No one is alone. And sometimes people leave you halfway through the wood, that others may deceive you. But you decide what's good. You decide alone, but no one is alone." So to me, the woods is the province of and. To wander into the woods and out of the woods and back before dark represents perhaps our zigzag journey as we wend our way through life from childhood. Careful the tale you tell.
That's lovely. Thank you so much. The province of and, boy, there's so much to say about that. So I'm curious, one of the ways you link this idea of the and, which is a sort of contradicts logic, right? It's a different operation. Am I right to say that you link that with the unconscious in some way?
Well, you can have a symbol that stands for something. A symptom, for example, that masks something else and keeps it out of your awareness. A child who's afraid to go to school gets sick or feels sick. And the fear of going to school is sort of masked by the illness. A person can be afraid of heights. All kinds of symptoms arise. And the symptoms are masking something that the mind is keeping out of awareness. So it's either or. But in this place of the woods, one doesn't have to choose. So the baker's wife has always been fascinated by the prince. All the way through the story, she meets Cinderella, she says, "But what about the prince?
Yeah, okay. Tell me about the prince.
Tell me about the prince." And the baker is unkind to her. He's very, we could say, male chauvinist if we want. I mean, he says, "You go home. I'm going to take care of this myself. I'm going to find the cape and the cow and all." But he keeps forgetting. And each time she tries to help him, he says, "This is my quest. I'm the one the spell was put on." And she says, "No, we both need to do this together to have a child." And eventually he realizes that he has to cooperate with her. And it happens in this context of the woods. It can only happen there. Perhaps if they hadn't strayed into the woods, this change would never have occurred to him. He never would have grown in this kind of way. Somehow we have to retreat into this space. And when eventually she has this moment with this prince who's searching now for another princess, he's tired of Cinderella anyway. So he's unfaithful. He's charming. He's, I've learned to be charming, but never sincere. He says, it doesn't mean anything to him. And it fulfills a fantasy for her, but it doesn't really mean anything to her either, except that it has this fulfillment of a fantasy. But it is a fantasy only. And she knows that she really understands that now, that, and she wants to go back. And it's at that point that she dies. She doesn't,
right.
She can't live anymore. What happens in the woods is not sustainable. What happens in your fantasy, what happens in your dream life, what happens in your daydreams isn't sustainable. It's very much, Nicole, the way art is. You know the painter René Magritte?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he has a picture which is called "This is not a pipe."
Right. Ceci n'est pas une pipe. Yeah.
"This is not an apple."
Right.
So what does he mean by that? I mean, he means that you can get a lot of pleasure from a picture, pleasure from a picture of an apple, but you can't eat the apple. It's a different kind of pleasure. You can only look at it, but it's not a real apple. Just as words give pleasure, you can read a book and be lost in a book, but it isn't the same as living your life. You can read lots of books about love, but it's never the same as being in love yourself. So this is, I think, this part of the aspect of this realm of the woods.
But in the sense that the woods are like the realm of art, it's not, at no cost either. I mean, like you were saying, the baker's wife, when she has this fantasy encounter with the prince, in some ways that's what causes her life. And in fact, earlier on when she's talking to Cinderella, she says, I would do anything to be in your shoes. I would pay any price, in a sense. And she pays a very high price. And another thing it makes me think of is at the end, there's a refrain about, you know, be careful the stories you tell. So there is a sense of this being, among other things, the realm of make-believe, the realm of fiction. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's completely innocent or that it has no consequences. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that. And I think it's very important to remember that these fairy tales, certainly the ones that are referenced in this work by Sondheim and Lapine, these fairy tales come from Europe. And Europe, in the time when they were being told, was forested. I mean, there were woods and forests and mountains of, you know, everywhere. It wasn't built up even as much as it is now. And those places were places that seemed mysterious. They were places where you could easily get lost, easily get hurt. As, of course, we see in the story of Hansel and Gretel. And so there is that sense of lurking danger. But your question is a profound philosophical, psychological, and even theological and ethical consequence, because it goes to the heart, you know, of the difference between thinking and acting. In some religions, even thinking lustful thoughts or violent thoughts is considered a sin. One has to confess certain thoughts, even if one doesn't act on them, as though there is an inherent danger in even having certain kinds of ideas. So it's moot. I think it's very interesting to think about. Other people feel that you can have any murderous thoughts that you want as long as you don't act on them. It's the behavior, the deeds that one must judge, not the intentions or the background of the complex of the welter of, which is what I think we see so beautifully and hear in this wonderful show where, and you know, I forget who it is. It's one of the great, is it Philip Pullman maybe, who's argued that fairy tales have no psychological surface whatsoever. People act, they just, you know. And what Lapine does here is he says, wait a minute, what was it like for Cinderella? What did it feel like for Little Red Riding Hood? He tries to delve into the weeds, if you want to use your of the psyche, the tangled weeds of the psyche, to try to come up with what was it like. She says, the little girl says, I was excited. Well, excited and scared. Right. It's marvelous. It's absolutely marvelous. It's just exactly right.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, you know, I've heard other people comment on the fact that they develop these characters, right? And they give them an interior life. But I think it's important that they're still fairy tale characters. So I think about, so for instance, in Bettelheim's book, Uses of Enchantment, he finds it very important that fairy tale characters are sort of generic, you know, that it's a girl and not Eliza or, you know, a named girl, because it allows the child in particular to project and to sort of use that character in a more plastic way. And I feel like they maintain something of that because it's still these fairy tale characters. So for instance, with the example of the princes, I find it interesting that, at least for me as a spectator, I don't attach any blame to the princes for their infidelity, for instance. You know, if they were an ordinary character, a named character that cheated on their wife, you probably would attach some blame to them.
But you don't, because they're the incarnation of the prince. And what's happened is that this character has been fleshed out. And you realize, of course, this is just part of who the prince is. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, they're still types. They're just much more complex types than we're used to them being in the originals.
Yes. You know, when the prince, when Cinderella's prince finds her at the end, you know, and he wants to approach her, and she says, "I thought you were mine. If you love me, would you have strayed?" And he says, "I thought if you were mine, that I would never wish for more. And part of me is content and as happy as I have ever been. But there remains a part of me that continually needs more." And she says, "I have on occasion wanted more, but that doesn't mean I went in search of it," and so on. But the notion that there's a part of me that wants more, that's true of everyone. And the difference between the person who goes out and gets the more, as opposed to the person who merely fantasizes it or reads about it or creates music about it or tries to find a way of playing it out in one's own relationship, you know, which is marvelous. These are very different solutions. But the deep truth of this conversation in the woods is what I think is the "and." You know, I love you and I want something more. And so many people could never acknowledge that at all. And I think that the woods is the place where these deep truths emerge.
What do you think about the fact that they chose the original, more grisly versions of the fairy tales? Most of the versions that they take come from the Brothers Grimm. So, for instance, in the case of Cinderella, we're far from the Disney version. First of all, there's no godmother. There's the mother. There's the scene where the stepsisters cut off pieces of their feet in order to try and put them in the slipper and then have slipper dripping with blood. There's the pecking out of the stepsister's eyes. You know, these are the original versions. What do you make of the fact that they chose those as their point of departure, as their kind of raw material for this?
Okay, well, I have two things to say about that. Let me just say this first. I'm very opposed to sanitizing these stories. Perhaps you know that over the course of the 19th century, the Grimm brothers collected these stories in the city of Kassel in Germany, and they were reissued. They collected more stories. They edited and re-edited them. And they came out in multiple editions over the course of that century. What was interesting in Germany was that the stories that were found objectionable were never the violence. It was the sex that was objectionable.
Right.
Rapunzel getting pregnant up there in her tree, that was not so good. But I want to say this. There is a brilliant book called The Magic Years by a psychologist from the University of Michigan who is no longer with us. Her name was Selma Freiberg, and I think the book was published a long time ago. It was published, I think, in the late 50s. And it's a book in which she describes what the world feels like to a child in the early years up to about the age of 5 or 6. And in that book, she tells a wonderful story. And the story is about a set of parents, perfect parents, who decided that they were going to sanitize their child's life and take away anything that could possibly cause any fear. And they had heard that children were afraid that they might go down the drain of the bathtub. So they took their little boy out of the bathtub and out of the bathroom before they let the water go down the drain in the bathtub. They removed every children's book that had an ogre because they didn't want the child to be afraid of ogres. The child had a little pet. Was it a fish or a bird? Let's say it was a fish. A fish in the fish tank. And before it was actually a bird, I think. And then the bird died, And while the child was sleeping, they rushed out and got a new bird that exactly looked like it and put the bird into the cage so the child didn't have to face death and so on. You get the idea. And then, lo and behold, the child began to have nightmares, the same typical nightmares that a child of that age would have. So what do we make of this? What we make of it is that children will come up with their own imaginative scenarios, and they will be just as violent and scary and upsetting. They will be monsters in the closet, and there will be, as you or I or the Brothers Grimm or the sources could imagine. And so these are iatrogenic. And where do they come from? Not everything comes from the culture. Some things come from the simple process of growing, of your body is growing. First, you know, the baby can control goes from the top down. So the baby can turn its head. Gradually, it gets down to the legs and it can sort of start to get around. And when the baby can crawl away from the mother, suddenly the mother isn't there anymore. It's terrifying. Or even before that, when the child starts to get teeth and can bite, you know, and these experiences of the body growing, I mean, we don't remember it, of course, but what we do remember, some of us, we can remember what it felt like to have our bodies changing in adolescence. If you're a woman, you think back to what it felt like when you started to grow, have your breasts grow, and you started to have hair on your body, you started to menstruate. I mean, these are huge, and you know how everything started to change for you. Now, in my case, the year that all those things were happening to me was the same year I experienced the first death. My grandmother died that year. And so it was this catastrophic year where I stopped being a child and my grandmother died. And it was just an overwhelming year. And I remember it. So I think sanitizing things, first of all, it doesn't work. And second of all, and this is Selma, Dr. Freiberg makes, I think, a brilliant point. She says, look, when the child faces scary things in the real world, the child, everyone, we all have to develop coping mechanisms. Why can't the stories be an introduction to that? The stories are a lead into that. Then you can talk to a child if the child feels scared and say, why is that scary? And what do we do? And so the child is experiencing something about coping, which, you know, goes in. And that's why, I don't know, I didn't speak to a James Lapine, but I feel so passionately that he did the right thing here to use these two.
I think so too. I think that they're very faithful to many aspects of the fairy tales, and beginning with a more authentic version to me is crucial.
Well, you know, another aspect of Into the Woods that relates to this topic is the mysterious man who turns out to be the beggar's father. He's like a ghost, and he appears and comes back. And then he says, but no one ever dies. And that's true because, you know, we dream about people that we knew. I certainly dream a lot about my father and my husband, who never met my father. Told me the other day, I feel I know your father, Ellen, because I talk about him. So, and there are a lot of deaths in Into the Woods. And people say, oh, so frightening. But there's deep wisdom here as well. I'm not in favor at all. I just want to be clear and I want you to understand. I'm not in favor of exposing children unnecessarily to horrible things.
Right.
But I don't think anything here is in that category.
No, I would agree with that. I mean, a lot of it is about confronting real fears and real lived experiences. No, I agree with you too. I'm not saying one should go out of one's way to expose them to frightening things, but that when it comes to their real lived experiences, my daughter was fascinated with Cinderella, which is often understood to be about sibling rivalry. It was interesting to me how, You know, it was certainly nothing that I did to get her to latch on to that. But as a little girl, we must have had, I don't know, 15 different versions of it. It was such an obsession. So going back to Into the Woods, as you said, it's in two acts. And there's a lot of sort of duality that takes place. A lot of we're in the same place, but not the same place. So in the first act, everybody goes into the woods and there's this ensemble and it's about seeking out wishes, you know, seeking out things that you want and so forth. And then in the second act, we've had the traditional conclusion of the fairy tale in the first act. And So in the beginning, you have Once Upon a Time in the beginning of the first act. And then in the second half, you have Once Upon a Time, pause, later. And I love the economy of a lot of this too, right? All you have to add is that one word, later, and you're in a different situation. So we have another ensemble song of Into the Woods this time, but this time they're going into the woods to find and kill the giant. So do you have any thoughts about that shift of what prompts the characters to go into the woods in the first place? Well, in the first place and then in the second place.
No, I think you said it very well. I mean, going into the woods in Act One is to try to make the wishes come true, to find a way of making the wishes come true. What happens, I think, is that life goes on, and this difference that we heard about at the very beginning that Cinderella's mother tree expressed to her, do you know the difference between what you wish and what you want, prompts these characters to realize that what they had wished might actually not have been exactly what they wanted. They end up being dissatisfied, unhappy, and then in addition to that, they learn that the price that was paid, the cost of these wishes was very high, the moral cost. There was wrongdoing, and that has to be rectified, that the end can't justify either the means or the beans.
Right.
So those, I think, are the motives for the second forays into the woods in the second act.
So is it the same woods, or has the wood changed too, the way that the characters have changed?
That's very interesting, Nicole, because somehow it's much more frightening, it's much more ominous than it was before. If you transgress and you feel guilty, the world doesn't look the same. And when you feel guilty about something, you feel people are looking at you differently. And you feel that the world is out of kilter because of something that you've done. And I think that these characters and this wonderful, musically, it's incredible. At the end, when they start to go through that blame, you know, it's not just Jack's fault because, you know, who gave him the beans and who... tracing it all the way back to the witch. Everyone takes part in this. It's a little bit like that wonderful Agatha Christie story on the train. Remember, what's it called?
Murder on the Orient Express.
Yes, mm-hmm. Where everybody
right,
is killed.
Right.
Yeah.
Everybody stabs. Yeah, I mean, the sense that moral culpability is kind of a shared undertaking, that there's no way you get out scot-free. And whose sin or whose, you know, we're talking about, it's hard to even say, you know, where it starts and where it ends. I think that's very clever as well.
It is, and it taps into something so human. I mean, do you remember, I don't know if you're too young perhaps to have had this happen to you, but when I was a little girl in school, if there was something that was done that wasn't right, and the teacher didn't know who the culprit was, the teacher would say, who, you know, did this, you know, put the frog on the whatever, and I will keep all of you after school. Everyone will be kept after school until the person comes forth who did the act, who did the deed. And I remember as a little girl feeling terribly guilty. I had nothing to do with it in reality, but it somehow tapped into some kind of residual guilt, because none of us is without sin, if you want to call it that. And I know that, I mean, this is very, so beautifully done. I mean, in the Jewish tradition, on the holiest day of the year, where people go into the synagogue and they recite their sins, I remember thinking as a child, well, why are we reciting all these sins? You know, I didn't steal anything. I didn't betray anybody. I didn't. But the community speaks the sins together simply because of the same beautiful notion here in Into the Woods, that we are all human. You know, that line from Terence, nihil humanum alienum mihi est, nothing that is human is alien to me. So no, I think that's one of the great sort of psychological insights that this show points to.
Yeah. And at the same time, I mean, what you're talking about also reminds me of this idea of, like, can we sacrifice one of us? You know, like the witch wants to, when the giant is looking for Jack, and she thinks maybe the giant will take any sacrifice to appease her sense of wrong. And she's kind of, the witch is like, you know, who do you want to take? You want to take a blind girl? You want to, you know, and the most of the rest of the characters are uncomfortable with this, you know, of we can't sacrifice one, you know, this idea that, like, if more of us survive, but we've given up one of us. It, to me, that had intimations of things that even touched, like, on the Holocaust. I mean, there was a real heaviness, even though it plays lightly because there's a lot of humor. What undergirds it is a much heavier ethical quandary, I think.
Right. I mean, it's that old sort of lifeboat ethics question.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, of course, in real life, in times of war and so on, people make these decisions, make these calculated decisions. If we send this number of men over here, we can save those soldiers over there. And they make these decisions. But it's a terrible point. I think now that, Nicole, that you pointed that out, I just want to say, I think it's absolutely marvelous what they do with the narrator. Because the narrator, who's like the stage master in our town, in Thornton Wilder's play, Our Town, he's the one who's telling the story. And he says, you can't sacrifice me because I'm the only one who knows the story. I have to tell the story. But the point is that we are all telling our own stories. We all have to be able to take responsibility for our own stories. And each of us, this is a wonderful moment where he says, no, you know, you can't sacrifice me because I'm the outsider. I'm outside the story. I can't be in it. I can't participate.
Yeah, no, I think so. It reminds me of the witch towards the end, you know, where she says, you know, careful what you say, children will listen. You know, careful what you do, children will. I should find the exact words. Yeah, when the narrator gets sacrificed, essentially, to the giant, then they're all responsible for telling the story. Oh, no, actually, you know what? It wasn't the witch's part I was thinking of. It was the baker's wife. She comes back. I mean, she's no longer alive, but she comes back as a kind of vision towards mm-hmm. the end. Mm-hmm. And she's giving the baker advice, who is now a widower and raising their child on his own, although he's going to be living with other characters. And she says, look, tell him the story of how it all happened. Be father and mother. You'll know what to do. Sometimes people leave you halfway through the wood. Do not let it grieve you. No one leaves for good, etc. And then at the end, she says, tell him what you know. That line really resonated for me. I felt like in some ways it was the closest that you get to a moral of the story, because there are a lot of morals that are offered up, and some of them are pretty silly. So they kind of undercut the sense of, you know, that there can be something like a moral. But this sense of the importance of storytelling, but telling what he knows, telling a faithful and honest story as being an important part of parenting. I thought that was really interesting, and interesting as a kind of something that takes over for the role of the narrator.
Yes, and it also, I think, It's pointing to a very beautiful way to be a parent, to be a father, to tell your son or daughter the stories of what happened before they were born, what the background is of their lives, and to pass it on to the future. It's something that I hope we are not losing in our very present-centered world of today, where everything is the latest news. The fact that this baker also comes into contact with his own father and has to reckon with that. And there's a beautiful moment, Nicole, that I think happens shortly before that, where the baker just wants to leave and get away from everything. And he says, I was never cut out to be a father. And then the ghost of his father comes back and says, don't do that. I did that. And I don't want you to do that. You don't have to do that. You can stay and work it out. So he improves on what his father had done with the help of the father who comes back and speaks to him in the same way that in real life, you know, we hear the voices of those, our parents and grandparents and so on. Those voices are still there.
And the father lives in the woods. So maybe that's an indication that you can go into the woods, but if you live in the woods, there's something wrong, you know. It means that you've run away in some sense, that you've kind of abdicated your role.
The notion of this mysterious, when I first see me, I'm mysterious and I'm deleterious. All of that is founded in the sort of spirits of the forest that are so important in the Eastern European and European tales. You know, there were, you know, elves and gnomes and, you know, spirits and wandering. And you can't imagine that. I mean, I remember walking to school through what seemed to me very small as a jungle, but was just overgrown, and thinking, you know, I wonder if there are fairies in there. I wonder if there are little people in there, you know. So I think he's a wonderful character. As you said, so perfectly, this actually does deeply figure the fairy tales themselves. And that's why when you asked me to join you in this conversation, I immediately thought of this.
Yeah, that makes me, just one more thing it made me think of. So in the beginning, one of the things that I kept wondering about is this an animate wood or is this an inanimate wood? And Little Red Riding Hood, who begins the whole sequence of Into the Woods, she says, the woods are just trees, the trees are just wood. But you know, when she says that, you're like, maybe, maybe not, you know? And then there's this tree where Cinderella's mother inhabits in some sense. So I thought that was very clever.
Well, the wolf is certainly lurking in the forest, and he's certainly...
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I was just going to say something about Cinderella and your daughter. One element of Cinderella that's always fascinated me is it really has something to do with the woods, but is that everything depends upon clothes. Cinderella becomes Cinderella when she gets her dress from, you know, in the operas. There are two operas. There's Cendrillon, the French opera, and La Cenerentola, the Italian version. And one of them, I forget which, the dress actually, if you see it at the Met, the dress actually comes down from the ceiling on top of her. But she, later on, when she is wandering around, she's not wearing her dress. She's wearing her rags here in the show. And she says, actually, out here in the woods, I'm not a princess anymore. And you know, from Polonius's advice to Leander's, clothes makes the man, you know, you be sure you dress properly. And it's not surprising that the most famous version of Cinderella is French, because she has to dress properly. And I think, I mean, I don't know your daughter, of course, but I think one of the ways in which Cinderella does fascinate girls is because of that. I love the little touch where Cinderella is dressing the sisters, and at one point she's pulling the hair, and she yanks the hair, and you wonder whether she's doing it on purpose or whether she's just lost in her reverie. But it's
right. Well, I think that, you know, the dress thing is interesting because children, I can't remember where I read this, but I read that at a certain point, children associate, for instance, gender with outside signs, you know, you're a girl if you have long hair and you're wearing barrettes, not because you have the anatomy of a girl. And so, and I definitely was aware of that with my daughter. Like, beauty also was a function of what you wore, hair length and things like that. It was very much externally marked. But I also think that for girls, and my daughter was like this too, the rags are almost as appealing as the dress. You know, it's both. It's the getting to switch back and forth, which is interesting. And interesting that the forest, I guess this is the way to bring it back, would be associated with the rags, which allow her more flexibility too. You know, it allows her to be independent, to be without the prince. I love the, I mean, this is getting off the path of what we, although here's another great line that I absolutely loved, where Little Red Riding Hood says, "But my mother taught me not to stray from the path." And the baker says, "The path has strayed from you." You know, at this point, like, the ship has sailed, which I thought was really great.
As you can tell, we could have continued talking about Sondheim and Lapine's wonderful musical for some time. But in conclusion, let me try and tie up a few loose ends. After we spoke, I wrote to Ellen to ask her once again about this relationship between the woods of fairy tales and the unconscious. I reminded her of what Bettelheim writes. Here's a longer quotation. "Since ancient times, the near impenetrable forest in which we get lost has symbolized the dark, hidden, near impenetrable world of our unconscious. If we have lost the framework which gave structure to our past life and must now find our own way to become ourselves, and have entered this wilderness with an as yet undeveloped personality, when we succeed in finding our way out, we shall emerge with a much more highly developed humanity." Ellen responded that she agreed with Bettelheim about the woods as a figure of the unconscious, but not with the claim, implicit in Freudian psychoanalysis, that a journey into the woods / unconscious will necessarily make us into better humans. "If the woods is taken as a symbol for the unconscious," she wrote to me, "it should not be taken as a place to go for a cure. Rather, it is a place to visit for expanded and deepened understanding. Understanding that may or may not lead on to altered actions and deeds back at home with others." In our next episode in this series, I'll be discussing the forests of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream with Randall Martin, author of Shakespeare and Ecology. In addition to the forests of fiction, we'll take a look at the actual forests of the past, in this case, of England in the Renaissance. In the meantime, I hope you're enjoying the spring. Please take a moment if you can to leave a positive review of this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell a friend to listen to In the Woods.